something is very gently, invisibly, silently pulling at me. A thread or a net of threads finer than cobweb and as elastic. I haven't tried the strength of it. No barb hooked, pierced, or tore me. Was it not long ago that this thread began to draw me, or way back? Was I born with this knot about my neck, a bridle? Not fear, but a stirring of wonder makes me catch my breath when I feel the tug of it, when I thought.
That poem is called The Thread by Denise Levertov. Well, preaching to the choir may be every minister's dream. For one thing, you can't go anywhere till the service is over. It's called a captive audience. But the choir are really among the stalwarts in a congregation. They are the veterans. They are the palace guard. They are the ones who keep the watch. So it is a great privilege to preach to the choirs tonight. And choirs have always had a tremendous impact on me. As I was saying to some of you earlier, one of my earliest memories from childhood is seeing the choir enter at an evening service at Old Simpson Avenue United Church. It was an anniversary occasion, and I think there must have been over 100 former choristers came back. And as the two large oak doors opened on either side of the Methodist sanctuary, the choir began to pour through with candles lit, choir couple after choir couple, filling the church with music. And as I think of them now and think of the people down over the years whom I've known, I see the faces of my friends surely on the faces of those choir years ago. And as I said to you earlier, I've said everything to you earlier, actually, but as I said to you earlier, I joined the choir when I was 12 years old with my dad. My dad said, why don't you come out and sing with us on Thursday night? So every Thursday and every Sunday and all the specials until I went off to university at 18, I was in the choir loft with my dad, and I learned a lot about the real church from the perspective of the choir stalls. You do, don't you? You learn things about choir-clergy relations. When the sun shines, all is shiny. When it rains hard. I've learned about choir joys and choir ferment. My friend Francis McNabb at St. Michael's Uniting Church in Melbourne dismissed the choir after a number of years. Just too much trouble to worry about, he said. And he brought in professional musicians for all the rest of his 46 years as minister there. I could see the faces of the congregation from sitting in the choir. You can, can't you? And you can see pretty quickly who's tuned out on you after the first hymn. And I actually got to see the minister at work. It's very interesting to see a minister at work from the side as opposed to from the front. You see someone licking his thumbs and looking through the scriptures because he can't find the passage to read, or someone crossing his feet as if he's waiting for a bus. And at choir rehearsals, you can overhear the minister in the office saying things like, I wasn't called to run a Gestetner, and cranking the machine up and so on. So you learn a lot about the church as it really is in the choir. And I also felt the desire in a choir's life to sing beautifully. Don't we want to sing beautifully every time and feel the privilege of doing that? Well, I've had the privilege of singing and listening beautifully over 30 years as the minister of this congregation. And this is my last year. I'm down to my last few months, but we're going to soak every bit of wonder out of it. And part of that wonder is Dr. Patricia Wright, with whom I have worked. We have been partners in ministry here since 1988. She has served longer than I have. And I can tell you that in the whole 30 years, we've never had an angry word, not an angry word. One day, she was playing a piece I'd not heard before, and I was sitting in my office on the third floor, and the piece moved me so much, I came flying down the stairs. I used to fly down them in those days, and raced into the chancel, and I said to her, what is that music? And she said, it's Veni Creator by Maurice Durafley. I said, play it again, and she played it again. I said, I'm going to go down now to the back of the church aisle, and I'm going to lie down on my back, and I'm going to pull myself all the way down the aisle by my heels, because I want this to be played at my funeral, and I want to see what it's going to be like as they're drawing me in. And I have a long list for my funeral, but Veni Creator is certainly on it, and I want you to hear it right now before I go on with this sermon. This will knock your socks off. Get ready. kind of worth dying, isn't it? We seem to be skidding these days in the denomination, and we have been. The decline started in the year I was born. I'm not trying to take that too much to heart. 1945 was the highest year of attendance and interest in the United Church of Canada. We've been sliding ever since, and these days it seems necessary to discern what kind of music it is that the culture is singing and what kind of music it is that the church is singing. My children and my grandchildren sing music all the time, world music and old favorites, and they know all the words, and they can tell you exactly where they were and what was going on in their lives when the songs appeared. But the culture seems to see churches as sort of an oddity whose songs are somehow not welcome anymore. So I ask myself, are we simply elevator music these days, trapped with people we don't know in a very small box and they won't shut the thing off? Are we oldie goldies, do you think, 50s favorites for those mostly over 50? And are we plaza muzak, played to keep the teenagers away from the door? Or are we restaurant background music, always too loud and always somebody else's choice when you're trying to have a nice evening? Or are we opera, I ask myself, a foreign language with too much death and endless exaggeration? Or a symphony, too lush to take it out to the real streets? Or rap, too rough and monotonous to enchant anybody? Or just a faint echo of once mighty choruses fading in the air? And I thought the song that's going to last and go deep is going to have a hook. It's got to have a hook, a turn, a phrase, a stirring beat. Mary had a little lamb, no hook. But big wheel keep on turning, proud Mary keep on burning. Rolling, 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 rolling on the river. Hook. You got the idea. In a recent lecture, Phyllis Earhart from Emmanuel College was telling us that the culture has obviously changed, and the churches in John Wesley's time were deemed to be behind the curve. The culture had changed. Industrialization had come to England, and people found themselves moving to urban areas, and they left their congregational base behind, if they ever had one. And the churches were behind the curve, finding no way to relate to what was happening these days. But Phyllis Earhart said, despite that, the chain of meaning was still present in people's lives. Even though they didn't attend worship, they still knew the story, basically because it was part of the culture. And Wesley, in his brilliance and his courage, simply lifted them up to the chain of meaning which they belonged to. But today, she said, the chain of meaning has been lost. It is three or four generations since anybody really knew the meaning of the thing. So we haven't found the hook, and people are hearing blandness from us instead of that which is saving all our lives. We found the hook once. I was the singer in a university band. It was a bit of a junky band. Some of the guys in the residence decided to put it together. We called ourselves the Leftovers because we're demure and Canadians, but we thought we were so good in the second season, we changed the band front to the Fabulous Leftovers and didn't get any more gigs at all. But we managed to play the Friday night dances at the university student lounge, and our musicians were so mixed that most of them faced the front, but the bass player faced the back so he could watch the fingering on the guitar of the lead guitar player, and that's what we did. But we had the hook. Our final song was Unchained Melody. Oh, my love, my darling, I hunger for your touch. We knew we were onto something when the big band in town came out to one of our Friday night dances and danced with their girlfriends right up to the stage and looked down their long noses at us, wondering who we thought we were. And we knew who we were because by the last song, everybody was hugging everybody because we had found the hook. The quest for the sacred connection, the thread for belonging, is still very powerful inside us, be we church folk or any other kind of folk. It's a human thing, and it's deep inside. We may paper it over with cynicism in our time, or we may see it broken by unspeakable tragedy and give up on it a while, but it is still there, this desire for sacred connection. The Bible displays it, if we were to read it, from slavery to promised land, from crucifixion to resurrection. There it is, the basic connection, the hook. Find the hook. I was thinking we still have a profound need to be loved, to be desired, and to be cherished, and to be driven wild with belonging. If we could lead with our longing, we would become a brand new church. Find the hook, touch the longing, and you win the day. I was riding back from the cottage not many months ago, listening to the radio. It's a long drive. I was listening to the CBC, and they played a song in the middle of the morning programming, and it was a song that I sort of had heard of or remembered, but I didn't really know it very well. And it's by Annie Lennox. Some of you may know it. And it's called No More I Love Yous. No More I Love Yous. And I listened to it. I used to be a lunatic from the gracious days, she sang. I used to feel woebegotten and so restless nights. My aching heart would bleed for you to see. Oh, but now I don't find myself bouncing home, whistling buttonhole tunes to make me cry. No more I love yous, the language is leaving me. No more I love yous, the language is shifting outside the word. No more I love yous, the language is leaving me. No more I love yous, the language is leaving me in silence. No more I love yous, changes are shifting outside the words. I nearly drove off the road. My heart's broken. No more I love yous. I'm not ready for no more I love yous, and I don't know anybody who is. How can we live in a world with no more I love yous? One Father's Day a couple of years ago, our daughter Janet took me to a concert with Paul Simon. Now, I'm not a huge Paul Simon fan. I know he's very gifted, but Simon and Garfunkel were sort of after me. I lost interest when Elvis went into the army, so it was downhill after that. But Paul Simon and his tight little band in the dark played a song called Stranger to Stranger, and this was the word. Stranger to stranger, if we met for the first time this time, could you imagine us falling in love again? Words and melody, so the story goes, fall from the summer trees when the wind blows. I can't wait to see you walk across my doorway. I cannot be held accountable for the things I do or say. I'm just jittery. I'm just jittery. It's just the way of dealing with my joy. It's just the way of dealing with my joy. It's just the way of dealing with my joy in the dark. I was fumbling for my pen to write that line across the program. Jittery, just jittery. It's just the way of dealing with my joy. The line went right through to my soul. And then the last verse, this time could you imagine us falling in love again, still believing that love endures all the carnage and the useless detours. Oh, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. I got the message. I got the message. And we have such lyrics in our sacred text. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is strong as death, passion fierce as the grave. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away, for now the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. And if I read that at a wedding, I tell the couple I'm going to take my shoes off, because every time I read this thing out loud, my toenails curl up. We need to recover the hook in the song. And one of the hooks we need to recover is that of inspiration. Are we fearful all the time these days? Are we resentful that the tide of faith seemingly has rolled out on us, feeling our little boats adrift and somehow sinking everywhere? How can we be our true selves if inspiration has left the room? Years and years ago now, my first wife came to my office one afternoon and said, I can't live with you anymore. And she walked out of the office and took the rest of my life with her. Oh, we tried to reconcile a while, but I remember at the end standing in my kitchen and her telling me over the phone, I hope you do well. I just can't do this anymore, and I really mean it, and I'm not changing my mind. And I felt myself going down and down and down through the mud until I actually landed on something solid, and I realized I could still move my arms, and I could still breathe in and out, and whatever was going to happen next, I still had a bit of life in me. But the time my children were taken from the home, I can remember sitting and howling in their empty bedrooms, howling from a very deep place, and being so sore inside that I would go and sit at a plaza on a bench just to be comforted by the sound of buzzing voices as people walked by on their way to shop. A very dark time. And in the evenings, I would come home and close the heavy drapes and put on a song on the record player, Fleetwood Mac, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. If you wake up and don't want to smile, if it takes just a little while, open your eyes and look at the day, you'll see things in a different way. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Don't stop. It'll soon be here. It'll be here better than before. Yesterday's gone. Yesterday's gone. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow. Don't stop. It'll soon be here. It'll be here better than before. Yesterday's gone. Yesterday's gone. And that song saved my life. And if I ever get to shake the hand of Mick Fleetwood, I will tell him so. I'm coming to believe what so many people have already known for a long time. I'm a late bloomer in this. I've come to believe that Jesus is a political event, not a religious event. The church's best response to the gospel of Jesus Christ is political, because it took place among real people in the real street. Jesus moved among the crisis and the clutter of real lives on the street, and power was released hand to hand. One voice stood up in the crowd and said, enough. Another voice stood up and said, Black Lives Matter. Another said, Me Too. And another, Toronto Strong. How we dream, how we dare, how we touch, how we dare restores the hook of inspiration, and we need the hook of inspiration. The times, they are a-changin', wrote Bob Dylan. Something happening here, what it is ain't exactly clear. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man comes to take you away, wrote Buffalo Springfield. And students in Parkland, Florida, have stood up in their youth and said, you will not kill your children in order to keep your guns. It stops right now. I was listening to the last speech of Dr. Martin Luther King delivered the night before his assassination in Memphis, Tennessee. Andrew Young, one of his young cohorts, was telling the story. He said Martin was always healthy, had a very tough constitution, but when he was feeling worried and feeling low, he would become ill and flu-like and would often put himself into the hospital for a day or two for a rest. We had gone back to Memphis thinking it wasn't a terribly dangerous city. There had been other places like Chicago which had threatened assassination. But Memphis seemed reasonably safe. It was a garbage strike. Although that morning when we boarded the plane, the pilot came on and said, we're sorry for the delay. There was a bomb scare on the plane. Dr. Martin Luther King is on board. And the plane had been guarded all night by the National Guard. They arrived in the city and Martin Luther King put himself to bed in the motel room. He said to his friend Ralph Abernathy, you go down and speak to them. I'm just too tired to speak tonight. Ralph Abernathy went down, saw the crowd, and came back and said, Martin, there are 11,000 people there waiting to hear you. You have to come. So he said, well, you speak, Ralph, and I will just stand up and wave. And of course, when he got there, Martin Luther King stood up and delivered an hour-long speech, encouraging them all the way. He said, I may not get there with you. It doesn't matter to me now, because we as a people will get there. And I have seen the promised land. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. And they cheered him. And the next morning, Young said, Martin Luther King Jr. felt like a new man, ready to go out on the Monday to stand with the garbage workers and to march with them. And that night at 6 p.m. before dinner, he stepped out onto the balcony to see if he would need an overcoat that night, and one bullet pierced his neck and killed him instantly. He was dead before he hit the ground. And his spirit, said Andrew, was given to the world, released to the world. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life, is a political statement, not a religious statement. And we have it in our own texts. There were two men in a certain town, one rich, another poor. The man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he'd bought. He raised it and grew up with him like his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for a traveler who'd come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who'd come. King David burned with anger against the man and said to the prophet Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." And Nathan said to the king, "You are the man." The gospel is political and it is full of inspiration. It's time to recover the hook of our eternal nature as well. We're here only for a time. The image which strikes me is that of a sparrow flying in from a dark window through the hall of a great castle lit with candlelight and with torches and then flies out again into the darkness. Sounds kind of bleak, doesn't it? But the point is, we are coming from a mystery and going to a mystery, and this mystery is not nothing. This mystery is everything. We are eternal creatures, and the line between the living and the dead is far thinner than we know. And we are being empowered by that which has come before, and that which is around, and that which shall come after more deeply than we know. One of the members of our congregation, a crusty member of the property committee, aren't they all crusty on the property committee? He came to me one day, a year after his dear wife had died. They had loved each other profoundly, and he was a mess for the year, an old man, an engineer. He said, "I've received a flyer about an engineering conference in Lincoln Cathedral in England, and my son lives in Lincoln, so maybe I'll go and see my son, and maybe I'll go to the conference." And then they wrote back and asked him to present a paper of the structure of this building, and he said, "That will be interesting." And the day before the flight, he came to me and he said, "You know, I feel very strange about this flight." And I said, what do you mean? Like the plane is going to go down or something? "No," he said, "I just feel very strange about it." I said, "Well, tell me when you come back." So he arrived back a few weeks later, and I said, "Well?" He said, "Well, I went to see my son, and that was always good, but I went to Lincoln Cathedral, and I opened the door, and I told the man who I was, and the man said, 'Yes, come and meet the woman who organized the conference.' So I walked up to her, and she turned around, and she was the spitting image of my late wife. She didn't just look like her. She was an absolute spitting image of my late wife, and she went on to tell me all kinds of things, and I was absolutely blank. And she said, 'Are you all right?' And he said, 'I'm not all right at all.' And then he said, 'I've got pictures of my late wife on my computer. Would you like to see them?' And they took a little side room in the chapel, and he was showing pictures over lunch, and the dean of the cathedral walked through and said, 'Oh, my God,' and kept walking. And the woman said, 'Tomorrow, come to my house and show my husband these pictures. He'd be dying to see them.' And the next morning he called, and the husband said, 'I'm very glad you called me. I need to tell you my wife died last night.' She was very sick for a long time, but felt she needed to go to the cathedral yesterday. And when she came home last night, she said, 'Well, as soon as I saw his face, I knew that was the reason I had to go there.' Now, there's going to be a funeral, and in about 10 days, my daughter is going to go back to London. Would you perhaps have dinner with her when she arrives back in London?" So 10 days later, up out of the tube came this young girl, the spitting image of his late wife at university. And they had dinner together, and at the end of it, the girl said, "My mother gave a message to my father for you. Anyone who has loved as you have loved is going to be all right." He said, "I felt like a million bucks." Later on, we talked, and I said, "Have you ever seen anything like that before?" He said, "Three times. When I saw my wife, Joanne, standing in the line at Varsity Stadium when we were both university students, I took one look at her down the row and said, 'That's the girl I'm going to marry.' And then years later, when our son was killed in a boating accident in Muskoka, we'd gathered at the funeral home. All his friends were there. And she caught my eye across the room and smiled. And I knew we were going to be all right. And then the third time was when I saw this woman at Lincoln Cathedral. And I said to him, 'What do you think it is?' He said, 'I think it's the love of God.'" We have it in our texts as well. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in the whole country, and he began to be in need. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and I'm starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went. While he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him and ran to his son and threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servant, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and was found.' And so they began to celebrate." The hook of our eternal nature that comes to bless us when we need it the most. So are you hooked? Do you refuse to settle for "Mary Had a Little Lamb" as the tune of our common life and instead choose to be lifted to the news that Mary had an incredible son and that he is the hook in the saving song of the world? For you see, we Christians are the choir in the nave of the culture. We sing for those who can't sing or those who won't sing, those too tired, too sad, too disillusioned, too preoccupied, too drugged, too guilty, too poor. We sing for those who cannot find the note but who would love to have just a little push. Sing the hook in the song, the cadence, the line, the beat, and don't be afraid, because we all feel the power of the hook calling out for us. None of us is far, very far from the chain of meaning.